And we're recording.
That we are.
We are recording. I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time, and we are back with the Ecstasy of Influence. What are we watching today?
Perfect Blue.
Perfect Blue. What do you know about Perfect Blue? Any interesting stories that relate directly to our family about Perfect Blue?
Only the one that we already shared last episode.
Which one is that?
The one where you were watching it when 9/11 happened.
So Perfect Blue is described by Guillermo del Toro. Oh yeah, because this is Guillermo del Toro's list of the most influential films on his career. And Perfect Blue is by Satoshi Kon. And what does Guillermo del Toro say about Perfect Blue?
It is perhaps one of the most intricate ones ever made.
You didn't read
a giallo. Yeah. A giallo for all, and dare I say it, perhaps one of the most intricate ones ever made in any medium.
Yes. Satoshi Kon's Perfect Blue, the late Satoshi Kon. This was his first movie. Came out in 1997. Was released wide in 1998. It wasn't a big hit, but he burst onto the scene with this. He followed it up with Millennium Actress and then Paprika and Tokyo God. Was Tokyo Godfathers his? Tokyo Godfathers, yes. So, Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, Tokyo Godfathers, Paprika, and then he died. Sadly. He had a major influence on Christopher Nolan, and a major influence on the director of Pi and Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan, Darren Aronofsky. Mm-hmm. To the degree that certain scenes from Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan are exact recreations of this movie.
Yep.
But Satoshi Kon was cool with that. Mm-hmm. He was flattered and was like, that works. Because this movie was a bomb when it came out.
Yeah.
And then he died. And we were very sad because he was still relatively young when he died. How old was he? 46. I am older than he was.
Yep.
Yeah, but pancreatic cancer is a B word, isn't it? So this is Perfect Blue. It is based on a novel or a light novel. You know what a light novel is?
Kind of.
Japanese light novel. Basically a light novel.
Yeah.
usually for YA age groups.
Is this the plot line of the movie?
Oh yeah, don't read that. But the light novel is called Perfect Blue, Complete Metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. I read it just the other day. I know about this movie that Satoshi Kon never read the novel. He got what he described, I think, as like a generally unreliable outline of the novel, and then he didn't follow it at all. But he got permission by the author to not follow the plot of the novel.
Okay.
I think he said that he only had to keep three elements. We'll discuss those elements when the movie is over. I read the book, though. Highly recommended. Very disturbing. Very upsetting. But also not the plot of the movie. What do you know about Japanese idols?
Like the idols, like Japanese idols, like the people?
Like the singers, yeah.
I know, I don't really follow them. I know, I've heard of them, and I know a bit about them, and I mostly know the, like, animated, like, Hatsune Miku.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that sort of thing, with the fun, like, songs and dancing.
Right.
And they have a cult following, and then people get really weird and creepy about it, and
that's literally the history of Japanese idols.
Yep.
Influenced by a very specific French film. I have it right here. Sylvie Vartan's appearance in the movie Cherche l'Idole from 1964. Super popular in Japan. And that just sort of inspired this new breed of singer. But yeah, in the 1960s and then the 80s and 90s were the golden age of idols. And then the 2000s, they kind of started falling out of favor a little bit. But I think that was also when people started being aware outside of Japan of what idols were.
Yeah.
These sort of manufactured products, these young women who had to, like, adhere to these very, very, very strict standards for the benefit of creepy, obsessive fans.
Yep.
And speaking of
Hey, that is still a thing in a lot of, like, K-pop and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's one person who got fired from a group because his girlfriend was made public and people were really upset about it.
Oh, people get really upset, yeah.
Which is insane and gross.
So, yeah, so idol singers still exist, but they are, this movie, Perfect Blue, kind of brought idols to the attention of the international audience in a way. So, I mean, spoilers, it's about an idol singer. So keep that in mind. Idol singer. Guillermo del Toro says it's like the perfect giallo. 81 minutes.
All right. In and out. out.
In and out. Like any good movie, it's not very long. Not even an hour and a half. Are you ready to watch Perfect Blue? Willow, let's head to the theater. You didn't have to clap your hands with me. We're back!
We are.
We just watched Perfect Blue.
You finally finished the movie.
I finally finished the movie after 23 years. I finally finished watching Perfect Blue. Thank you, 9/11, for not getting in the way again. This was your second time through it, though, because you were very small when you were, in a way, watching it 6 days old. How do you feel now?
It's a good movie.
This is a very good movie. Satoshi Kon's Perfect Blue, his first feature film, somewhat inspired by Perfect Blue, the novel, but not really. Mm. Some of the same characters I was pleased to see. The main character was essentially kind of the same person. Mm. Rumi was her best friend and personal assistant in the novel, but yeah. Was also her age and had auditioned to be an idol but didn't quite make it. But also Rumi in the novel just ends up being like almost a victim but also saving the day. Like she's not... None of this stuff happens.
Yeah.
The novel is pretty much about an idol singer who's not becoming an actress. She's moving on to like more adult music. And so she's becoming a little flashier, a little more sexy. Mm-hmm. And there's a stalker who starts writing threatening letters and saying, you can't change, don't change, don't change, you're ruining it. But then it becomes this whole thing about, like, there's an actress named, I want to say it's Eri Ochiai, I don't know how you say the name, the same name as the actress who was in this movie, but who's another idol singer who secretly like sleeps with people to get them to do what she wants and write negative articles about other idols, and the killer ends up like kidnapping her and cutting off of all her face because he wants to wear the skin of an idol, and like his whole goal is to like kidnap an idol and strip all their skin off so that he can wear their skin. It's a whole thing.
So it's the plot line of the TV show that was happening.
Basically, yes, there was echoes in the show that she was in, but none of the whole like what is real, what is not, none of that. She's just stalked by a stalker.
I think this is one of those movies that you finish watching it and then you have to go back and watch it again.
You have to go back and watch it again.
Because looking back at some of the stuff that was going on, like when we saw the fish were dead and then we saw the fish were alive in that same sort of like cut, I think what happened was the real Mina was with the dead fish and then it cut to Rumi thinking she was Mina or Mima with the living fish. Like I think there's a lot of flashes of Rumi actually being Rumi and not Mima that are interspersed, like when they were in the Mima was in the car with Tadokoro or how Tadokoro and she ran out of the car to go chase after the like hallucination. I think that was actually Rumi.
You think? Okay, so some of the well, let's go back.
Yep,
let's walk it back, because this, as you said, is a movie that benefits from multiple viewings.
Yep,
and is a bit of a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a real Rubik's race, a real Rubik's pyramid, because things happen and then they unhappen and then they happen again.
Yep,
and then they unhappen. There's doubles and triples of people and flashbacks and flash forwards and flash sidewayses.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I think in the end, it all pretty much makes sense.
Yeah.
Except because what you've got is you've got a psychological thriller going on and also a different psychological thriller going on, because you have someone who's pretending to be your main character, but also the main character, is her sanity is slipping a little bit. Like she's got her own business going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you combine those two like plots together and you get a pretty confusing little film.
Mm-hmm.
But that it ain't only 81 minutes long.
Yep.
So not a wasted moment.
Nope.
Pretty brutal.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty explicit.
Yep.
And not for kids. Not a kid's movie.
No.
On a scale of My Neighbor Totoro to this is further on this end.
If the scale is My Neighbor Totoro and this, then of course it's further on this end.
this is this.
Yeah.
Totoro's over here.
Yep.
Yes, and not on My Neighbor Totoro. Cartoons, Not just for kids anymore.
Never just been for kids.
Not just for kids. This is a. So what's our basic plot here?
Basic plot. Mima is a former Japanese idol. Mm-hmm. She was part of a girls group called Sham. I'm so glad we switched from the dub to the sub.
Right, we started off with the dub, and I don't know. The dub was pretty good, but you really want to hear this music.
Yeah, in Japanese. And she's leaving the group because it's hard to tell if she wants to be an actor or if they're just not making money off of the group anymore. So they're like, you should do acting.
Yeah.
And she joins up with a TV show, and her agency is pushing the TV show to include her more. And as time goes on, her shows get more and more. Like the show, there's a rape scene in the show, and that's when things start kind of falling apart.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty brutal rape scene.
Yeah.
And they bring up that Jodie Foster did this for, mm-hmm. oh God, I can't even remember the name of the movie anymore. But Jodie Foster did a rape drama
mm-hmm.
that got her first Oscar. It got her all this attention. She had been a child actor mm-hmm. up until then. I mean, she had done some pretty serious stuff, and I liked that they brought that in. They're like, this is a career.
It horrifically traumatize Jodie Foster as well?
I mean, she was already horrifically traumatized from her life as a child actor, but you have this scene being filmed mm-hmm. and I did appreciate that the actor who's on top of her, they don't position him as a villain. He mm-hmm. he apologizes to her for how horrible the scene is to do. So you get this like nice remove. You're like, okay, this is a real scene.
Yeah.
Then it just starts, her life starts spiraling out of control.
There's a couple of seat moments, like reading back we're looking at the plot right now on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
When Mima finds the evidence in her closet of the murder, I'm not entirely sure it's Mima still.
Right.
Because it was in the bedroom, and I want to go back and watch it again to see if I can tell what the bedroom looked like, because I didn't pay attention to the posters or to anything on the walls, because there's two bedrooms.
Okay. Well, let's, before yeah. we, so she gets cast in this show
mm-hmm.
where she's doing nudity, she's doing sexual assault. She also appears in a photography spread.
Yeah.
That you said was doctored.
I think it was, because we saw the original photo shoot and the picture, there's scenes, poses that she does in fully clothed that appeared in that magazine where she was naked.
Fully nude.
Yeah.
But regardless, what happens is people start dying.
Mm-hmm.
The screenwriter, the photographer, they get brutally murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And she also has a stalker.
Mm-hmm.
Someone sends her a letter bomb that explodes in her manager's
hands.
Mm-hmm. It's okay, though. It's just a prank.
Yep.
People start dying. And there's a stalker you see who's already attacked some people who were harassing mm-hmm. her in her final performance. And also, a website has appeared that is her diary.
Yep.
But not.
But it's not hers.
But it knows intimate things about her.
Yeah.
So, on top of all this, the plot of the movie she's in is about a woman.
Woman who, well, it's not a movie. It's
or
a TV
show. Yeah.
It's a
Criminal Minds-esque show.
Yeah, it's a crime drama about, I think the main characters are a detective and a psychologist.
Yeah.
And they're trying to solve a murder of a guy who peels women's skin off. And her character is the sister of one of the victims.
Right.
Who gets raped at a strip club and develops dissociative identity disorder. And then it ends up her being her as the killer.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they discuss this mm-hmm. in the course of the movie at times when you're not sure if it does a really good job. But
mm-hmm.
because she's in a movie or a TV show, sorry.
Yeah.
Because she's in a TV show, it will cut back and forth mm-hmm. between her filming and her in life. And the editing is so disorienting mm-hmm. that there are times when you're not sure if you're seeing real life or if you're seeing her performance.
Yeah, there's a scene during one of the takes where it switches suddenly to her being just actually the killer and her having developed this persona of Mina.
Mm-hmm.
Or Mima. I keep saying Mina. Mima instead. But I think that was fake. Like, I don't think that was real.
Right.
Because based on how the rest of the movie played out, I want to, what does it say about, like, because it doesn't say anything about that scene in the plot thing.
Which scene?
The scene where she's recording, but it's framed as if the detective and the psychologist are actually real detective and psychologist.
Right.
And they're interviewing this woman who thinks she's in a TV show.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it shows it again, but she's a woman who thinks she's a model.
Yeah, and that's her character.
Right. What was your question about it?
It's really unclear whether or not that's real. Like, which one is real? I think the acting is the real one. I think she was just having some issues.
Yeah, so one thing that Satoshi Kon does is not give you any obvious indication as to whether something's in her head or not. Yeah. There's a scene where they're filming outside. At one point, it's raining. In one version of the scene they're filming outside, it's not raining. She keeps seeing hallucinations of her stalker, but is she... There's multiple times when she wakes up repeatedly. You think she's waking up from a dream. Then she wakes up again in the middle of that, and then she wakes up again, but then, like, it flashes back, and she relives a scene. But then you find out... So throughout this whole thing, you are convinced... that her personal assistant...
Her manager.
Her friend, Rumi. But not her roomie.
Not her roomie.
You were like, I think she's the killer. I think this is really her. I think this is her. And spoilers, lo and behold, it does end up being Rumi. Yeah. But not Rumi, because Rumi also thinks she's Mima.
Yep.
But also Mima sees Rumi as Mima.
I don't think she does. I think that's just the audience seeing that.
Do you? I mean...
I don't think Mima sees her that way. I think it's just meant to represent when Rumi switches between personas. No,
but there are times when Mima sees this ghostly Mima and is startled because she thinks it's her.
Yeah.
So,
I think Mima is actually experiencing psychosis.
Yes.
I think she's been really... I think there's actual real... trauma that she's dealt with as part of what, like, everything that's gone on. And I think that she, reading this Mima's room blog, because there's the blog, is causing her a lot of stress, and she's being stalked. There's a lot of stress there. Like, I think she's actually experiencing real hallucinations and PTSD, which is then made worse by everything else that's happening.
Yeah. So that's what I was saying before. You have a person who's experiencing hallucinations, trauma, PTSD, and another character who's also experiencing hallucinations or has a dissociative identity disorder and believes she is the character who is also hallucinating. You put them together, man. Can they get along in the city? I don't think so. This movie has brutal murders. It has a rooftop chase at the end that just is dynamite. Fisticuffs. People getting hit by cars.
Someone getting stabbed with an umbrella.
Someone getting stabbed in the eye. Someone accidentally...
She didn't kill the guy. She knocked him out.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. So, yes. Mima ends up being attacked at the end by her stalker, who goes by the name Mimania.
Because Rumi has been emailing him pretending to be Mina.
Yes.
Mima. Gosh, I keep saying Mina. Mima, and she's told him to kill and stuff.
Yes. But Mima puts up quite a fight, and even though she gets stabbed, even though she gets, like...
She doesn't get stabbed by him.
She does.
He
has the...
He stabs her in the shoulder. That's right.
He's gonna kill her. He's gonna sexually assault her. And then, in the midst of all this, she manages to grab a hammer, hit him in the side of the head, knock him out.
Yeah. The hammer just looks like it was blunt on both ends. Right. Like, how did that kill him?
And then he ends up getting killed by Rumi.
Rumi, for failing to kill her.
Right. We see his corpse. She also kills her manager.
Yep.
She kills the photographer she's killed. We've seen the murderer once. Mm-hmm. We just know it's a woman in a cap and a jacket. Mm-hmm. And when you see her up close, it looks like Mima. But of course, as you said, that is simply because we're seeing the action through Rumi's own eyes. There's no indication that what we're seeing is a hallucination or a flashback or anything. The screen is almost always, there's always sort of a dreamlike quality anyway.
Yep.
So I did love, there's a moment near the beginning-ish of the film where Mima almost gets hit by a car, or she thinks she gets hit by a car, and then she wakes up. And anyone watching the movie is going to go, I bet at that point she actually was hit by a car and she died and we're seeing like this. And then at some point she actually says, I bet I died when I got hit by the car. Thus, like, extinguishing that trail of thought. Like, that was the one that I was like, that was smart. Like, because that's what people are going to think of when you get hit by the car. It's yeah, there's it's brutal. It's a brutal little little film. And no one, and the two main hallucinators don't end up dying at the end.
No. Mima actually saves Rumi's life.
Which is wild.
And they don't get isekai'd by the truck, as how it happens in any other animation. But Mima saves her, and they both get taken away in an ambulance. Most likely, that's what the people in the truck were calling an ambulance. And then at the end, Mima is visiting Rumi in the institution, a mental institution.
Yeah.
And the doctor is like, yeah, she still thinks she's you most of the time. And apparently, according to Wikipedia, she's a well-known actress at this point.
Well, yeah, because the nurses recognize her.
Yeah.
And you know, her former group, Cham, which is the best name of any group, Cham. Cham has gone on to be a success.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this sort of dark ending, just in the sense that, like, she goes through all this mess, and, I mean, she's still going to be an actor. Like, she's worked too hard at this point. Like, as traumatic as this whole thing has been, that's the road this life takes you, and it's brutal, and it's hard, and, yeah. So this movie came out. It was well-received.
Yeah.
It was, like, it premiered at the 1997 Fantasia Fest in Montreal.
Okay.
Didn't get released until 98 in Japan. It got really good reviews. I mean, some reviewers didn't care for it as much, but it got overall really good reviews. And then kind of flopped. But everyone who saw it was like, this is amazing. This movie is amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, we have never seen anything like this before. And as we said, Requiem for a Dream recreates the bathtub scene.
I can't believe this man denies that Black Swan was inspired by this.
If you look at the two bathtub scenes together, they are
exactly the same.
Identical.
Yep.
And it's very clear that he's homaging this moment.
But why did he deny that Black Swan was inspired by
this? Since he denies that Black Swan was denied by Perfect Blue, even though Black Swan isn't a recreation of Perfect Blue, but it has so many of the same sequences. But again, they're also both pulling from similar visual traditions.
Yeah.
So that these aren't the first psychological thrillers that had, like, seeing your double look at you in a weird way in the window. And like the use of windows, the use of mirrors, the use of duplicate rooms. I mean, this, you can go back I thought of Vertigo a lot when I was watching this. A lot of just, like, the doppelganger effect, the double effect, like, who's lying to whom. I would put this movie on par with Vertigo as far as, like, who's zooming who here? Who's lying to whom? Who is the double? Who's crazy? Who thinks they're crazy? Who's being told they're crazy? Who's the actual villain? Who's the killer? Like, it goes along. This is one of those movies that, even if it's been spoiled for you, it's still worth seeing.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those movies that you have to go back and watch again so you can see. I want to watch this movie again so that I can see when I think we're actually watching Rumi versus Mima.
Yeah.
Because I think there's probably a lot of subtle, like, hints in the background of when the POV is changing.
Mm-hmm. So they talk about, there's a little bit of the analysis here from Susan Napier. He says, Perfect Blue announces its preoccupation with perception, identity, voyeurism, and performance, which you can also tie into oh my God, the guy who did Strip to Kill, and, oh my God, who is the filmmaker who tried to be Hitchcock and succeeded to some degree, but all of it, hold on.
You didn't open the new tab.
Oh. Oh, I wasn't thinking of Strip to Kill. I was thinking of, oh my God. I suddenly can't think
of... Just look up Guy Who Wanted to Be Hitchcock.
Brian De Palma. Even though I didn't see it, Brian De Palma. Okay. So what was I saying?
Something about Brian De Palma.
Tying
it in voyeurism.
He says, Perfect Blue announces its preoccupation with perception, identity, voyeurism, and performance, which Brian De Palma explored all this, like, in the late 70s and the early 80s. Like, that was what he was doing. The notion of, like, you're always being seen, you're always on camera, you're always being perceived in some way, especially in relation to the female, right from its opening sequence. But then she says, Mima's madness results from her own subjectivity and attacks on her identity. The ties to Alfred Hitchcock's work are broken with the murder of her male controllers. And one thing I noticed about this movie is it goes from being this attack on a woman to this attack by a woman. to this triumph by the woman, and all the men are killed. Like, it subverts that original notion of the thriller, and I would say the giallo,
the Black Widow character, isn't the femme fatale isn't this like over sexualized person.
Right.
Like, she's clearly bad because she does like try and get this guy to rape and murder another woman.
Yeah.
But it's like the femme fatale isn't this. A, she doesn't die at the end, and B, she's not romanticized or like she doesn't manipulate men.
Right.
She just kills them.
Yes. That's what that. Yeah. It's almost as if this movie is a pushback against the femme fatale.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is no femme fatale because the use of sexuality in this movie is seen as something that happens to women, is forced on women by the men who all die. All the women survive in this movie, to a one, and all the men, all the main men end up murdered, for sort of forcing this controlling lifestyle onto, and you see Rumi weeping during the filming of the assault.
Well, because, I would too, honestly.
Well, yes, it's brutal and hard to watch, but because she sees this as an assault on not only Mima, but on herself, who she is believing to be the true Mima.
Yeah.
It's messed up.
It's a messed up movie.
It's a messed up little movie. Now, how do you feel about this movie being called by Guillermo del Toro, like, kind of like the ultimate giallo?
I think I haven't seen enough giallo films to confirm nor deny this, but I do think this is a very good one.
Right.
I think that, because we've seen a couple of them, I do like this one most. I think the motivations and the sort of complex, like, insanity stuff that's going on is really good. I also think Mima is a very compelling POV.
Yeah.
I think that Rumi is a sort of, I don't know how to describe it, because I can't say Rumi is a sympathetic character, because she sort of loses that for me at the end when she tries to get this guy to rape and kill Mima, which I can't tell. I don't know. Like, I guess we don't know if she told him to just kill her and he disappeared.
Yeah.
Like, it's
that's
a thing,
left pretty vague.
But like, still it's that thing where she was a sympathetic character and then she tried to like murder the
hero.
But I still think that she's somewhat sympathetic given her mental break from reality.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what, because she was also an idol originally. She mentioned that in the beginning.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much of that was her own trauma from what she went through as an idol.
Right. And watching this young woman go through it, but she's like, it's weird. She has, it's almost like she's has a dissociative disorder on another person.
Yeah.
It's like she's separated someone else's personality into two halves and has then adopted one of those as
her
own.
Well, because that's what it's in a lot of crime nonsense that what stalkers and things like that do is they obsess over an idealized version of a person and make that person reality, and when that person deviates from their perfect creation, they get violent. This is, again, TV show psychology.
TV shows, but not true.
Yeah, so it's that thing where while Mima was still an idol, everything was fine because Mima was being Mima. But once she started deviating from that, Rumi couldn't reconcile reality with whatever and was like, this is obviously an imposter. And that just sort of, she just sort of, her psychosis developed to the point where she's like, I am Mima.
And
because Mima, when she was Mima, didn't think Rumi was the same person. She thought Rumi was someone else.
Right.
Because Mima said, oh, Rumi just stepped out. Or Rumi as Mima said, Rumi just stepped out. I'm here.
Right.
You're an imposter.
What I love is that the novel is very much about like, the life of an idol is dangerous. Mm-hmm. The life of an idol is objectifying. The life of an idol they over-sexualize you by desexualizing you. And then when they do sexualize you, it triggers like this reaction from the fan base. And in the novel, the killer is a fan who goes nuts. It's your typical obsessive fan thing that does happen in real life. What I like about the movie is that it takes that as a base and then pushes further past it and makes it be like, that's just a symptom of the problem. And this woman, Rumi, is a further extension of the fallout from this weird world.
I think there's a lot to be said as well about the sort of, in this world, there's the view of women being forced into sexuality, and then there's the view of women choosing to be sexual. Like, there's two different, like, sides. Because both of them, when... Like, both sides of this, Rumi and Takata, I can't remember his name, the other manager, you can read it both as Rumi taking away Mima's agency over herself and him taking away Mima's agency over herself by either forcing her into being sexualized or by forcing her into not being sexualized.
Right.
Like, Mima is making choices.
She is.
Are they good choices? Meh. But they're her choices. And it's that sort of thing where, like, can we... is Mima truly a victim in these situations, or is that just Rumi's perception? Like, what is actually happening? Because I do think there are some scenes where Mima has clearly had a bad reaction to what has happened. I don't think she necessarily wanted to do the rape scene.
No, she even says. Yeah, she breaks down and cries.
Like, she thought she had to. Yeah. And so there's that sort of forcing her into that position. But then there's also, like, the photography thing. Like, I want to go back and watch this movie because I want to make sure that I got that right, that the nudity pictures or whatever were actually photoshopped. Because then that just negates the whole choosing thing.
Right, but
especially, like, now, looking at it through a modern lens where it's a lot of women, like, putting themselves out there because they want to. It's just a different vibe.
Yeah, and... Mm-hmm. And what I really liked about the vibe from the movie is that, going back to the giallo thing, I have watched a lot of giallo. I've watched a lot of good giallo. I enjoy it. I enjoy that as a genre. It's got its rules, and it breaks its rules, and it's fun to watch. What I liked about this is this accomplishes what in many giallo, because many giallos have the weird, I'm thinking of like Deep Red and stuff. They've got like the, is this person the killer? Oh, this person is the killer, but wait, they're actually working for this person. Who's...
Deep Red was actually the movie that made me think Rumi was the killer.
So what I like about this is in giallo, the psychological reasoning, the revelations, all that is frequently shocking, but also comes across as kind of funny or goofy a little bit in giallo. Like, there's a campy quality to it.
Yeah.
And you kind of laugh along with the disturbing revelations, and you're kind of like, oh my goodness. This, because it's animated, so there's this consistency of image, this consistency of vision. Everything looks a little weird and off anyway. But because the animator has complete control over the appearance of our characters, there's not like, I watched a giallo where in the end you find out that like, this person was actually this person all along. Oh, when we watched the Sorcerer movie the other day, and you're like, wait, that was actually this guy the whole time. Like, because there's none of the makeup that's needed, there's none of the hiding the faces that's needed, there's none of the disguising the voices that's needed, it's very smooth and it just flows, and you just sort of trust what's in front of you the whole time. You're not looking for the seams, or you're not looking around the corners all the time, because it's animation, so you're given the final product.
And with animation as well, you don't have special effects, like funky bat puppets.
There's no bat puppets.
Or fake blood or anything like that. And you don't have... I would say that animation can push things a lot farther than actual, film can.
Yes.
Just because with film, you have to worry about people's safety.
Yeah.
But with animation, especially when they were filming that, like, rape scene, that was... You didn't have to worry about having an actress actually being McMahon-handled.
Right. You could make this movie in live action.
I don't think you should, though.
You could. But, I mean, it's physically possible to make this movie in live action. There's certainly been... Every 30 minutes, my camera does this thing. It's a flaw in the camera. It's a thing. I've looked it up. You could make this movie in live action. It would be expensive because of just the weird, like... Especially at the end, like the weird rooftop chase scene with the special effects, in order to make it not look silly, you would need a master filmmaker to make it not goofy.
You'd need a master filmmaker, and you would need a lot of safety.
Yeah. But even if all that was taken care of, you would have to work almost 10 times as hard.
Yeah.
To pull off what they were able to pull off in this anime. I thought this movie was really good. Mm-hmm. I can see, and I watching it, I can see where Del Toro was like, mm-hmm. especially when you think of like his Nightmare Alley and stuff yeah. like that, like just him with like the psychosexual weirdness, mm-hmm. just there it is for you. And I never felt like the main character was being exploited for the sake of the audience. Like mm-hmm. there was, it got pretty graphic with her at times, but I felt like because it was animation, I felt like the whole thing was in her head at like we were seeing through her eyes. Mm-hmm. So when you saw her naked, it was like you felt
like the only time that it feels exploitive is when it's supposed to
feel exploitive. But like, I felt like because I was inside her mind mm-hmm. the whole time, when she felt exposed, I felt exposed.
This feels like a movie that somebody would do poorly and add a main character who's a male.
Mm, yeah, well, if it was a giallo.
Yeah, I think that's why it worked. I think a lot of giallo films, for me at least, always feel a bit funky just because we're not experiencing any of the victims. Like there's, I can't remember what movie it was, but it was the movie with the bathtub that boiled someone alive.
This is Deep Red.
Deep Red, okay. That we followed a woman for that one, didn't we?
Well, the main character is a man and a woman.
Yeah.
And that was the movie that like broke the boundaries by having like right. a competent woman as one of the leads.
Yeah, so it wasn't Deep Red that that made me think of that Rumi was the killer. What is the Italian film that we watched?
It was Deep Red.
Was it Deep Red? But yeah. Was that the
and
one where
the mother ends
the mother.
Up,
okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a long reason, movie with a lot of plot.
Yeah, for some reason I thought those two movies were different. But
nope.
I don't know. It just worked. It worked well.
It worked well.
I couldn't remember what my point was going to be. So
81 minutes. Mm-hmm. Also, less than an hour and a half. Just bam, bam. In and out. Also, great songs.
Yeah.
The
good
band,
soundtrack.
Yeah, Cham was great. I really mm-hmm. enjoyed it. There's a great Power Rangers parody at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You get to see the Super Sentai, some Super Sentai characters doing their thing. That's fun. Mm-hmm. Great just encapsulation of Japan in the late 90s, mm-hmm. sort of coming off their ride. I was reading about the history of idol singers, and the popularity of idol singers waxes and wanes with mm-hmm. the with their economy.
Yep.
Like the better the economy is, the more popular idol singers are because people can spend more money being mm-hmm. fans. But once you can't spend the money as a fan,
well,
it all goes away.
I think that works with a lot of different like celebrity yeah. things, because once you're in dire straits and you see this person living like with cash to spend, you're like, I don't like this person anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to turn against this person.
Yeah.
So Satoshi Kon does this movie. It doesn't mm-hmm. do that great. He follows it up a few years later with Millennium Actress, which does a lot better mm-hmm. and gets a lot of attention. And then Tokyo Godfathers just put him over the top. Tokyo mm-hmm. Godfathers was just a phenomenal film. And then he did Paprika, and then he sadly passed, as we said. But this movie has great mm-hmm. a great legacy. People love it.
He did three of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
He did. He did direct three episodes of JoJo.
Also storyboard artist and animator.
Yeah, if you're interested, I believe he wrote an autobiography, or at least he has published journals. Mm-hmm. His life was just basically like, guy wanted to be an artist, got into art school, got into being he was assistant to, I believe, the guy who did Akira as a manga artist, mm-hmm. and that led him into animation, and then he got the opportunity to direct his own thing, and you know, the rest, and now he's, you know, just a few movies, but he's, you know, four motion pictures, and he's considered one of the masters of, mm-hmm. of Japanese animation. So, yeah, that was Perfect Blue.
It was perfect.
It was Perfect Blue. Oh, and when asked about the title, of course, he's like, people have asked.
Oh,
like,
what were the three things that he had to keep in the
movie? Oh, the three things he had to keep in the movie, right, were, I believe it was, oh my gosh, I believe it was an idol.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be about an idol. Hold on, I have it right here. He did JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. He hadn't read the original novel. He only read the script for the film, which was set. So there was a script that was optioned. The script came out, and he talked to the original novelist. Was like, can I change all this? He's like, you have to keep that they're an idol, that it's horror, and that there's a stalker, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that's it. I think that was like the three things. Everything else was added. He took from a lot of different, he had a lot of his own influences and mm-hmm. made this movie.
Yeah.
That's it. Perfect Blue. Hey, but hey, this isn't the end of our movie watching.
No.
What's our next movie? You don't know. You don't know it. Well, let's find out. The next movie on the Ecstasy of Influence is...
What is this? Oh, The Prince of Egypt! Yes!
1998's The Prince of Egypt?
I haven't actually seen this movie, but I've heard a lot of its music.
Another animated film, but kind of the opposite of Perfect Blue.
Also considered a really great animated film, though.
I saw Prince of Egypt, I think, in the theater? I can't remember. It's been a long time. But we're getting to some religious drama. We're getting a little Bible story. We're moving away from ultraviolence and into...
Ultraviolence.
Well, yes, but we don't actually see any of it. Sort of family. I guess we do have the death of the firstborn coming up, but we're getting a Passover story. The Prince of Egypt, Val Kilmer.
Musical.
Is Moses. Steve Martin's in it.
We're going to have to...
Jeff Goldblum is in it.
Good. It's a musical.
It's a musical.
It's awesome. So, I'm so excited.
Stay tuned. We got Prince of Egypt coming up. So until next time, I'm Phil.
I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when...
It's Del Toro time.